lost his voice this week, so we're releasing a formerly paywalled interview with Professor Adolf Reed. And become a Substack subscriber for an exclusive look at Katie using the brand new Taibbi dating app. And now, here's Adolf Reed.
Yeah, I don't know if this is partly a generational difference or what, but some of my friends and I talk about this, that it, so, all right, so off at one extreme, right, I sometimes you recall Ernest Everett Just, the black biologist, I think I got his first two names right, who was a pioneer cell biologist in like the years between World War I and World War II. Started Howard. He was a graduate student at the University of Chicago around World War I in biology and chemistry. And I sometimes think about this when I hear the sort of complaints about how painful and hurtful it is to be like the only tenured black full professor at Columbia, whatever. That, can you imagine what it must have been like for this guy, like every day? And that's not saying that that should be, you know, the standard.
Sure.
But even fast forwarding through my parents' generation and mine, frankly, there's just shit you put up with, right? There's shit you understand is part of the cost of life. And if you want to think about what, you know, racism or racial insensitivity are, that's at the quotidian level. That's what that kind of stuff is. And if you spend all day as on a front-seeking missile, then you'll drive yourself crazy, you'll drive everybody else around you crazy. And it's like, I used to think it was a kind of, so like in the 80s, when I was teaching at Yale and there were, you know, POC kids who would, who were undergraduates, who would get all kind of worked up about, you know, somebody passing them and not speaking to them on the sidewalk or whatever, and wondering whether the professor didn't call on them because of their race, whatever. I sometimes just felt like, you know, putting my arm around them and saying, well, you know, like when my son actually got swooped up by a cop, he and his friend on the way home from school, walking past the Peabody Museum of Natural History. The cop, by the way, for what it's worth, was a black cop with a jerry curl. And the police major whom they sent out, you know, to do the cool out the community thing was also a black dude named Major Blackman. You couldn't get any better than that. But when he got home and I found out what had happened, because he and his friend had been swept up as supposed suspects who had tried to rob the food shop right next to the apartment that we lived in. And the proprietors saw the kids and they berated the cops. The first thing I said to him after blowing up for about a minute was, well, okay, so you've had your black bar mitzvah, right? Because you just got swept up by the cops, right? So this was going to happen at some point. It happened, so it's over. But it's not like, you know, I had to take him to therapy like Charles Blow did when his kid got stopped by a Yale cop, because this is, but anyway,
yeah,
that was then. Now it feels to me a lot more like the reaction is connected to commoditizing the status of being a victim of a racial affront. And that, I know that to some people, that's gonna make me sound like Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter. And we're together for about the first 10 feet of a marathon. And then we part company and the gap gets wider and wider as we go along. But I just wanna make that clear. But I may as well say this now, because I was thinking about saying it anyway, and I mentioned my son already. And this is pertinent to the D'Angelo stuff. He reminded me, I'd completely forgotten about this, that when he was in either the fourth or fifth grade, he came home with the wisdom that a teacher had given them that day, that racism equals power plus prejudice. And he said he brought that home and laid it out for me proudly to show what he had learned today. And he said, my instant reaction was, oh, well, that's stupid. And of course, we had a conversation about it later, but that's just to underscore how long this stuff has been around. So I guess by that reckoning, Hitler didn't really become a racist until he was named Chancellor.
Right.
Anyway.
That's interesting.
In the early 90s, there was like a brouhaha centered in Georgetown in DC about boutique operators who had a buzz-in system for their small ateliers, right? Who wouldn't buzz in black men because statistically speaking, young black men were more likely to commit crimes than other people. And the thing was outrageous, of course, the argument was outrageous. But I participated in a faculty seminar with a bunch of, kind of moose heads, some on the law school faculty at Yale, and it was a seminar about race that was connected to mainstreaming courses on race and gender into a major. And a line that came from several of my colleagues was that, well, like, he's kind of got a point there. And I said, no, like, the only person who is violating any law here is the shop owners who are violating the 1964 civil rights law. So unless you want to argue that anti-discrimination law is less real than real law, right? Then there's a problem. But people could feel comfortable making that argument, right? Partly because of the extent to which something called racism is like disconnected from the substance of actual practices, right? Look, I'm prepared to grant that D'Angelo's heart is in the right place, at least on the left side of her chest. But she's probably earnest. But you know what? And I apologize for mentioning my dad again. But I remember once we were watching when I was around 9 or 10. We're watching the Billy Graham Crusade on TV because there was nothing else on TV. And we watched for a few minutes. And I learned two things. The first thing I learned was that when they announced that one of the guests and performers was going to be the singer and actress Ethel Waters, right? What came out of my dad's mouth involuntarily was, God, I didn't know she was broke. So I learned that there's a connection between when popular entertainers find Jesus and when they run out of money. But the other thing that I learned was more telling was that he said, listening to Billy's sermon, he said, God has really been so good to Billy since the Hearst family picked him up off the street corner after World War II, that I'll bet he probably even believes in him now. Right. And that's kind of the way that works. And I'm convinced that Robin DiAngelo is sincere, but unsurprisingly, as my dad often also said, sincerity is very much an overrated virtue. And then he would point out by saying Hitler was sincere at what he wanted to do, right? The problem isn't his sincerity, it's what the fuck he wanted to do. So I don't know. I mean, but I'll be willing, or rather I am willing to grant D'Angelo that she thinks she's trying to do the right thing. I mean, so, and in that sense, I mean, however she might strike us, and I don't really encounter her. I don't encounter her on TV or I don't read the stuff or whatever. But however disconcerting or annoying or off-putting she might seem to people as an individual, she's a symptom, right? I mean, she's a symptom of a much bigger problem.
Like Trump.
Yeah, really. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, could we dig into, Professor, about how big that problem is? I mean, clearly, if they're sincere and there's a little bit of there's almost like a church like thing around this belief system, but right. Like they would consider you an apostate to their belief system, right? I mean,
flattery will get you nowhere, Matt.
But I mean, how do you see this whole thing as a fad that's sort of gripping kind of the educated classes right now, or is it something that's more worrisome? Like, for me personally, when I read the book, I kind of laughed through a lot of it. And then there are parts where she talks about how it's necessary to eliminate universalism and individualism and that, it's get back in touch with our collective white identity and things like that. Wow. And I thought, wow, this stuff is kind of dangerous, isn't it? Right. Like, do I have that wrong?
For one side, she says explicitly, I think citing Kendi, right? She actually says, mm-hmm. like, whites should be viewed, we should generalize about white people, but we should view BIPOC people as individuals because they've been so pathologized and denied of agency. It's this weird like moral reparations thing. I'll find the actual quote, yeah. But I was kind of stunned by that.
She has a whole section about how stereotyping is okay. There's a whole chapter that's named
right, but in one direction only. It's okay. Totally infantilizing.
Wow. Yeah. Dehumanizing, well, no. Honestly. Yeah. Yeah, totally, totally. And that's interesting. But I want to say, Matt, first, I mean, you deserve a Purple Heart or at least a really nice dinner for having read that. Well, no, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. I mean, I know that in principle, that's the logic of her position. And I will say this, it's not exactly a digression, but it's a kind of a response to the apostate thing. One thing I have found over the last decade or so, and I think this is partly because of the emergence of the sort of DSA Jean Phil race first crowd, that my tank is just about full of white familiars, as I call them because of my affinity for the Blade movies.
Those are excellent movies.
Yeah, totally. But well, my favorite scene that comes to mind at least once a week was where in one of them, I forget which one, Blade asked the police chief, who is a familiar, just before he kills him, do you really think those bloodsuckers are going to let you live after they win? Which is what I feel like asking all kinds of white white race first, I mean, leftists that I know. So my tank is basically full now from white people in particular telling me that I don't understand the depths and intensity of racism and its effects and this, that, and the other. Not because they're violating a normative or an epistemic principle of mine, right? But theirs, right? By the shit that they argue, they technically don't have the right to say shit to me. So why is it that I'm the POC that you can tell that he's got it wrong, right?
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And I've taken to calling that out, right? I mean, lately. And the best way to call it out is just a simple, hearty, go fuck yourself, right? And I just might get a stamp. I haven't said that on it. I mean, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think it's really important to try to sort through how all this has come to happen, right? And because we're facing such a perilous moment in this society now. And there's one way you can look at this, right? Progression, okay. 2016, so, all right, the Democrats haven't done shit for working people since before Jimmy Carter. And I sometimes raise eyebrows when I point out that working people as workers, you know, without regard to race, gender, whatever, actually got more from Richard Nixon than from any of the four Democratic presidencies that followed him, right? I mean, not counting, Biden yet. So after decades of not doing anything for working people, whatever color, and saying instead, sneering in effect, don't worry, like we'll come back for you, but we got to take care of Wall Street first, right? People react and they react against it, right? And Obama, so like the Democratic establishment, the liberals all told us that Obama told us this, right? That because of his race, right? And he didn't put it that way personally, but what he did do was say that I embody the progressive vision. Well, what the hell does that mean, right? Right. I mean, how does he embody it more than Kucinich, especially if you think hobbits carry the progressive vision? And I would vote for Kucinich tomorrow, so don't get me wrong.
But we love him.
Yeah, great. So I don't know, we should start a club and like send him some money for the mayoral race, but which would be fitting actually, because that's how he got fucked in the first place, right? I mean, he was mayor of Cleveland. So that didn't work, right? And that's when people who were told that trust this guy, right? Like he's gonna be better than Clinton. He's not gonna fuck you over the way Clinton did because, you know, he's black. Well, that didn't happen. And then Trump comes along and my God, you got Hillary Clinton and look, like I'll admit to anybody that a lot of the antipathy the sort of pornographic and antipathy to Hillary Clinton was sexist and a misogynist. And it sometimes made me think of how people talked about, or a certain kind of person talked about Jane Fonda half a century ago. She was also the consummate neoliberal operative who couldn't communicate empathy to anybody, right?
And didn't want to. It didn't seem like it.
Right, right.
She couldn't sell it like her husband.
No, totally not. No. So you got Bernie challenging this. And then all of a sudden, Bernie Sanders is like a racist white man because the only, because black people don't give a shit about healthcare and education and jobs and wages. Right, all they care about is police brutality and the reparations. All right, so that works. It gets people on MSNBC, right, and so forth and so on. Also does kind of significant work for the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And then Bernie comes back in 2020. And though I'd hoped that this, what would have happened after 2016, it didn't quite, for reasons that also are understandable after the fact at least. But Bernie's 2020 campaign actually leaves residue on the ground in a lot of places around the country for actual movement building and organizing around Medicare for All, right? I mean, we did it in South Carolina, for instance. And then almost on cue, when Bernie drops out of the race, you would go into COVID lockdown. And I'm not claiming any connection. I mean, don't get me wrong, but I don't have a line of pillows to sell. But I think the difference is that, as somebody once said, a part of the problem is that our side plays checkers, the other side plays chess. And they are prepared, and they have the apparatus to do it. It's not that they're smarter than we are, but I mean, they're better situated to take care of opportunities that present themselves and to turn small opportunities into big opportunities. George Floyd's murder, and I'm not trying to diminish that like in any way whatsoever, right? But George Floyd's murder helped them and the POC activists who are oriented against the left, basically, right?
Left punching.
The real left.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, here we are. And I mean, it's not just as crude as you do that and the $2 billion in pledged corporate money comes in. But I do recall, though, I mean, going back to, you know, the beginnings of hashtag BLM, I saw a panel with Garza, Tometi, and Colors, and was genuinely taken aback at how Garza seemed, and I remember her because she did most of the talking when I was watching, seemed literally incapable of considering even to reject that there could be a distinction that I mean, there could be like a millimeter of daylight between activity that advances a broader movement and activity that embraces or that advances the position of the brand holders, right? The three of them, right? And they're the same to her. And I think that's kind of what this movement is now, right? And it makes sense. It makes sense because of how, you know, the social insurgencies of the 60s have been reduced or characterized, right? As like, I mean, for a time it was like, I remember saying that like, you know, you go to any middle school or grade school or high school in the country on the 15th of January and ask people what they know about Martin Luther King, and they say some version of a long time ago, people didn't have any freedom, and then Martin Luther King came and they were free, right? But so, like, what one of the things we've forgotten collectively, right, is that movements don't just happen because somebody shows up with a bullhorn and a selfie stick. Right, and organizing and preparation and a rootedness, right, in actual populations that are made up of people with names and addresses and phone numbers, of people who, if they don't have addresses, right, can be found, right. In that sense, I'm not even blaming the activists, but it's like a rotten political economic dynamic that's taken shape over the last half century, and we could go on about its sources and its consequences and entailments all day. But what I'm especially concerned about now is 2022 And, you know, I don't think Biden's a gift to the world. I think Biden's going to fuck us ultimately, whether he intends to or not. But if at a minimum, the Democrats can't hold Congress, and ideally, like, you know, I'm not that kind of political scientist, so I don't have bets about what Senate races they can win, when, where. But ideally, get a real majority in the Senate. And by the way, that would include Biden acting towards Sinema and Manchin the way that Lyndon Johnson acted toward the recalcitrant Dems in the Senate, right? It's okay, yeah. Right? Oh, you don't vote for this, then you never see another fucking bridge in your state, right? I mean, which is how that's got to go. But none of the Democrats since then have been at all inclined to do any of that. But if that doesn't happen, then, you know, I think that that's going to be the end of American democracy, right, in the next year. And yeah. And all of these, what's the best way to characterize it? All of these performative tendencies that occupy the cultural space that a serious left would occupy in the U.S. if there were one, are in effect working for the other side, right? They may not think they are, they may not be getting paid, but they're in effect, I'm working for the other side. I mean, look at the defund stuff, right? That's a problem we never had to have. And yeah, I mean, Republicans would have found something else, but the fact that we give it to them just gives them space to mobilize an opposition against anything. So, I mean, this is the reason, actually, Katie knows that the Debs Jones Douglas Institute that I'm associated with, it's like a 501c3 that was created as the educational arm of the Labor Party in 98, is sort of refocusing our work now, because we think that being able to do anything else, right, to win anything, or to fight off the worst even, is gonna require a lot of aggressive agitation around the idea of government and the public good, and to try to rekindle among the working class, basically, a way of having expectations of government and public goods as part of the public good. And there's not a lot of time, obviously. We can't turn that around between now and next November. But we got to start having the conversation. And the only way, Tony Mazzocchi, who was like the key person in the origination of the Labor Party, a longtime official of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, used to say, you know, a lot of progressives, you know, like the idea of going to war, but they don't want to build an army. And we don't have one, right? And if you start out from the premise that we're, you know, in a class war, and it's kind of hard to have missed that since Volcker, right? Then if we're in the class war, then we need to start trying to build an army to fight it, right? And no, I don't mean like in case some right-wing troll comes across us. No, you know, I don't mean going to form our own version of a militia movement. I mean, a mobilized and class conscious public, right? That's prepared. Like our key premise is, what would the country look like if it were governed by and for the interests of the working class? And that's what we think ought to be, like, you know, the interpretive cornerstone, as well as the pragmatic cornerstone of what a serious left in the U.S. would look like.
She says openly, like repeatedly in the book, on that theme, mm-hmm. that, for instance, talking about class, not race, yeah. that's like in her list
right.
of things right. that white people say as a way of deflecting from their inner racism.
Okay.
Right. Or I don't see color. I just see everybody as individuals. Right. I believe in class first. So these right. are all things that are part of her shtick.
Right.
You know, part of me thinks that maybe she actually thinks that, but I wonder if the enormous amount of attention that she's gotten and support, and the fact that she's blasted all over the cable networks and everything
right.
is connected to what you're talking about. In other words, that this idea of class, not race, is actually is a racist right. idea mm-hmm. is a way to diffuse that politics that
right.
you're talking about, right? The sort of right. Sandersian, you know, Medicare for all, any of those right. things. If you can explain that stuff away as, you know, as white privilege or whatever it is. I mean, that seems like it's very effective kind of politics.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be, yeah. And I think it is because of the level at which politics or political discourse is acted out or plays out in the US, right? It's like MSNBC and crying ass Don Lemon on CNN.
With backup by Jake Tapper crying with him.
Oh, yeah, right. No. Oh, Lord, Jesus Christ, have mercy. Yeah. But I'd go back to like when Katie asked me about racism. So if you think of, and my friends and I who are, accustomed to being accused of being class reductionist, have been talking among ourselves about actually taking the label back.
Right? Yeah.
Because if you think of race as a social category, the way I defined it earlier, right, as a species of a genus of ascriptive ideologies that emerge from a hierarchical society like in ours, a capitalist one, then the question of class versus race is precluded from the outset, right? Because there's no separation, right? Race as an ideology and as a metric of stratification is part of the dynamics of the reproduction of capitalism as a social, cultural, and political economic order. So there's no such thing as class versus race, right? Mm-hmm. That might not appeal to her. Fundamentally, we should be looking to appeal to her, right? Right to her, or for that matter, to the Black people that she hangs out with or connects with. There's certainly no reason to listen to Kendi. Somebody told me that my friend Norman Finkelstein just said on a podcast not that long ago in response to somebody saying something about Kendi having written a kid's book. He says, well, how can you write a kid's book? All his books are kids' books. And Norm is right about that. He's used about a lot of other things.
Yeah. Right? He compared D'Angelo's book to, I think, a Bazooka Joe comic or something.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. On our show, yeah.
Not even the whole comic. It was like a frame from the comic, yeah.
Well, so I don't assume that, either one of you is even old enough to know what a Bazooka Joe comic is.
Yeah,
but we do, for sure. So, here's the thing, right? We aren't going to win the struggle at that level, by which I mean, we're not going to win the struggle on the pages of the New York Times. We're not going to win, the struggle on the airwaves of MSNBC. Although I got to say, Chris Cuomo did me a solid on his program on CNN, and he got in touch with Don Lemon because of it.
He got you on?
Yeah, he did, actually. He got me on to talk about one of the New Republic columns about, I can't remember now whether it was the police killing thing or which it was, but he was into it. He read it, took it seriously, he engaged, and was open to the argument. And he was even encouraging the argument by some of his questions. So anyway.
Adolf, can you explain to people, I think sometimes people think that, Matt and I and you, obviously, we all have fun making fun, dunking on Robin D'Angelo. She's so corny. She's such a narcissist, I would say.
We should read them. That there's a scene in there where she's
oh my gosh,
she's she's in London, and she's with a cabbie, and she mentions that she wrote White Fragility, and he says something about I'm so tired of being accused of being a racist, and she goes on and on to denounce him, and at the end she says also worthy of note was his typical white lack of racial curiosity or humility about the limits of his knowledge. He had the author of a New York Times best-selling book who was in town to do interviews for the BBC in his cab, and he did not ask a single question about my thoughts on the matter.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, see, now I thought I had the best cab driver story ever.
What was it?
One evening I was taking a cab from my apartment, in Alphabet City up to Penn Station. And I would always talk to cab drivers to get a sense of where they came from, whatever. And the driver in this instance was a woman, an older woman, and she, frankly, she reminded me a lot of my grandmother, right? Both physically and by her feistiness. So I asked her where she was from, and she told me she was from Romania. I asked her how long she'd been in the U.S., and she said 10 years, 10, 15 years, whatever. So I said to her, well, I guess you must like it because you're here, right? You're still in New York. Why? Just fool that I am. And she said, there's only one thing I do not like about New York.
Oh, no.
And fool that I am.
Oh, no.
I said, oh, what's that? And she said, the Jews. Well, but my first thought was, well, so you know where you came to, right? Like you could have gone anyplace else in America, I'm assuming, just because the former war criminal networks are still operating, I'm sure.
Right.
But this is like the worst possible fucking place you could go, right? If that's your concern. But anyway.
Yeah. Go to you know, Northern Maine, if that's who you're.
Right.
Where you're, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember when Solzhenitsyn came here in the Carter administration, and Carter found out what a backward ass czarist, fascist, and anti-Semite he was. But they stuck his ass up in Northern Vermont, I think.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the Russian emigres ended up in that part of the world. Yeah. And a whole community.
Well, yeah. But anyway, that's kind of wild.
That's really funny.
I mean, D'Angelo thinks that a random cab driver like in London should know who the fuck she is. I mean,
right. Right. God. Yeah. See, and to put that in the book too, I'm like,
yeah, no, I know. You think an editor might have caught that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to say, like, when I thought the question was going toward, narcissism and stuff. Like I flirted with going to the seminary for about 6 or 8 months when I was like 12, and I didn't. So I don't need to hear her confession. I'm not interested in her confession.
Right.
I got no absolution to offer her. but I mean, I do think that she's like a symptom of this stuff, and she's carved out a niche for herself in it. But apparently, that's what people do now, right? You carve out occupational niches in the, you know, movement
right
for justice.
Can you talk about the way people like D'Angelo and the kind of thinking that she spreads, or the gospel that she spreads, actually serves to undermine class programs that are universal but also disproportionately benefit people of color, and how then she ultimately winds up contributing to something that perpetuates racism?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing about it, man. I mean, and like I've got, see, I mean, I know that this is not the way the world works, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I find myself at least every other week seeing some new instance of the fundamental contradictoriness of race first politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like some version of, you know, the racial, oh yeah, well, a recent brouhaha on the internet, I don't know if you saw it, but Tamika Mallory, the black woman who had been was the center of a contretemps around the organizing of the Women's March after Trump got elected.
Mm-hmm.
She just did a Cadillac commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's so much shit like that, right? Like the Patrice Cullors real estate mini empire. And
oh, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. But all the rest of that stuff. And I find myself thinking, okay, well, surely this will knock the shackles. This contradiction is so stark that it will knock the shackles off the eyes of some percentage of the population. But it doesn't work that way. Actually, that's really never the way these things work. What we do see is an almost magisterial effort being expended from the top, basically, to keep us talking about race and gender inequity and nothing else, and not even talking about those two in ways that promise any possibility of addressing the inequalities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like the whole COVID disparity stuff, you know, that I've been writing about from the very beginning of it. If you start out demanding that we all understand that there's some special disposition that people of color have to getting sick and then dying that has to do with their being people of color, then that distracts you away from what eventually came out, that, well, it turns out that the racial disparity breaks down to what kind of jobs you work, what the conditions are you work under, what what kind of conditions you live in, how dependent you are on public transportation, and so forth and so on. So it's back to political economy. But but the totality of post-World War II racial liberalism has been articulated toward, if not when not openly directed toward, separating race as a discourse of injustice, basically, or of inequality, not just from something called class, but from political economy, and shifting it to psychology, ultimately, is what it comes down to, or worse, like what the Afro-pessimists have done now, is they've taken 19th century race theory and Madison Grant and like repackaged that as progressive Black ideology. It's like crazy. I mean, they're in bed with the worst of 19th century racists.
Right. It's almost like a crypto eugenics type of
thing. Right. You know, and see, that is a class program. It's a class program. Then, like, I figured something else out too. And like, this is actually a chapter of a book that I'm working on now, a book that my colleague and friend Kenneth Warren and I are doing. But I've been puzzling with addressing the question of why so much anti-racist discourse now depends on analogy with slavery and Jim Crow, right? Like, you can't do it, right? I mean, you can't make the arguments without the analogy. And that's ultimately because the political as well as the intellectual concern of the people making these arguments is exactly the same as the political and intellectual concerns of the defeated Confederates who established and propagated lost cause ideology, the myth of the Solid South, and put all those Confederate monuments up, because they were committed to a racialist understanding of the world for the purpose of undermining any possibility of a political economic challenge coming from the lower classes, basically. That's the same reason that people making the arguments or race reductionist arguments today can't really move without drawing links between this moment and slavery and Jim Crow, because they're just as the 19th century former Confederates or Southern ruling class was committed to a white supremacist narrative, they are also committed to a white supremacist / anti-white supremacist narrative for the same reasons, right? To keep political economy off the table and to advance their particular class program, just as the planter class was in the 19th century. So, I mean, the sociologist Rogers Brubaker, whose work on ethnicity mainly centers on Central Europe and is great, but Brubaker makes a point that, you know, like we all know, people have a hell of a lot of different identities, right? And people have a lot of different ethnic identities, even, right? In most places in the world, and most of us do, right? But they're usually not politicized. I mean, they're contextual, and one identity rises to the fore in social context, depending on who it is that you're talking to, or you know what the context is, right? So, I mean, Brubaker sets himself to ask the question, well, what are the conditions under which ethnic identities become politicized? And his response is that usually, most of the time, they become politicized when a group of political entrepreneurs, as he describes them.
That's an interesting term.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Are committed to pursuing agendas that require the support of a population that's considerably larger than the number of people who would benefit from realizing the agenda. Look at this outrage. I need to be king, basically. And we can see that, right? Even now with the race reductionist stuff in the US, right? Like, so all of a sudden, it turns out that the victory for George Floyd is some Oscars for some more Black people, right? Some new Black corporate heads, CEOs, right? And I mean, whatever like that. But that's the way that this stuff works. And it's not just here, right? I mean, that's what ethnicity is as a political phenomenon, right? That's what nationalism is and has been from the beginning of nationalism, right? But it wasn't, right? I mean, most people don't think of it as bourgeois nationalism because it was the bourgeoisie's property. So it would have been redundant to call it that, right? And it still is. So it's a class program. So that's why, right. I mean, that's another reason that Touré and others and I have been arguing that.
Touré is Professor Reed's son, just so people know.
Sorry. Yeah. But he's an historian in his own right. But
oh, sorry. Yes, of course. Sorry.
No, I didn't mean that as a corrective. At this point, he's accomplished enough that I've forgiven him for going to a college that didn't have a competitive baseball program. But every time I see a picture of Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonds, I would think, man, see, that was supposed to be my retirement strategy. No, he's a fucking historian. But anyway, but it made the argument, and he probably most forcefully, that the problem isn't class reductionism, the problem is race reductionism. And that's what the point of race reductionism is to make class dynamics not only like in the broader American society and political economy, but among Black people, right? I mean, disappear, right? I mean, so this is anecdotal, I know, but I really don't believe that I'm falsifying memory here. But, you know, I worked in the Sanders campaign both times, and more in 2016 than in 2020, I would have these interactions with smaller or larger groups of Black people in which somebody would ask why Bernie's not doing anything to appeal to Black people. And my response was invariant. I would just go down the platform item by item, read it and say, okay, or recite it and say, so isn't this something that Blacks and Latinos would disproportionately benefit from? And people would agree. And the part that I don't think that I'm falsifying in my memory is that I don't recall one encounter with working class Black people. And all right, so these are mainly people in unions, but not exclusively, where at the end of my recitation, the response wasn't, yeah, okay, I see your point, right? I get it now. That's right. I can barely recall a single interaction with people, with Black people from our class, right, that produced the same or provoked the same kind of response. Because for them, what they understand to be the Black agenda, right, is this class skewed abstract set of positions stances, right, that are connected with recognition of the standing of the racial voices or themselves as representatives of the collective racial mind or will. So for them, I mean, I remember now, like, and in retrospect, it makes me feel kind of stupid. I remember like having a couple of conversations with my colleagues in the Yale Afro-American Studies program, like in the late 80s and the beginning of the 90s with, where I'd say something about my political economic issues, a lot of it had to do with the underclass ideology, which was also a class ideology about beating up on poor people. But I get responses, kind of dismissive responses from my colleagues about stuff like national healthcare and shit, who would say things like, well, Adolf, you know, people aren't just concerned with economic stuff. And what I would think at the time, but was too genteel to say, was, yeah, you don't, motherfucker, because you got a job for life and good benefits, right? But a lot more Black people are not in your position than are. You know, I didn't say it at the time, but now I think, shit, I should have, because that's what the reality is, right? Because what we've been living through over the last half century, and this is the beauty of the work that racism as a polysemous abstraction does, of crafting what is a sort of a racial, a Black racial concern with public policy as an exclusively Black investor and a managerial class perspective.
Isn't this sort of just an extension of like, I mean, it reminds me of the response to Martin Luther King after the Riverside Church speech, right? Where it's like, suddenly all these white intellectuals were right. basically saying, yeah, we were all for it as long as you were right. talking about your issues. But then right. when we get to war or, you know, right. sort of union issues or whatever it is, like that's not for you.
Right.
Stay away.
No, and that's right.
Right. And it's almost like they've institutionalized that concept now. And it's funny, even in D'Angelo's book, she's just relentlessly negative about King for a bunch of reasons. I think it's for okay. that, but also this, she's very against this idea of the colorblind society. Like, right. you know, she confuses the idea of people copping out by saying, I don't see color with the aspiration right. to colorblindness. Right. right. But I think it's goes deeper than that. Right. I think it's a lot of, it has something to do with what you're talking about. It's this, we understand, she wants everybody to understand this issue to be solely and especially concerned with something that is clearly identified as a racial right. problem.
Yeah, I think there's a parallel there, and there's an irony too, right? Because substantively, yeah, I mean, but the reaction that King got was that no, there's a civil rights thing over here, and right. that's just about that stuff. But shit like war and the economy and poverty, that's not a civil rights issue. And what we're hearing now, but now it's coming like in black, right? And from people who like understand themselves to be, you know, followers of Malcolm X or, you know, the Black Panthers or whatever the fuck, or operating in that same tradition, right? Who are now doing the silencing, right? So, and look, guys, it's so insidious, right? It's the kind of thing that makes me like at least once a week want to put on, Mahalia Jackson singing "Soon I Will Be Done with the Troubles of the World." this was some solace because it's so insidious. Right? It's coming out of the labor movement now, right? I mean, people, right? So black workers can't just be workers, right? They got to have some special black thing about them, right? That. But I'm not denying that black workers are black as much as workers. But to keep with my prior illustration, black is the adjective, worker is the noun, right? But the thing is always, how do we try to build the solidarities that we need to have to change the society in the ways that make it better for everybody who lives in it, except, you know, Bezos and those people. But the practice, right, of this performative race-first politics is completely disconnected from any sort of pragmatic question like that. And it's not only disconnected from such questions, it tends to be so essentially antagonistic to pursuit of such questions. Like it makes me want, look, I mean, I remember COINTELPRO, right? I was like a victim of it myself far enough ago in the past. So I wonder, God, are these people getting paid? And then I think, well, no, they aren't getting paid. Like they don't. Yeah, they mainly aren't, I guess. I mean, they don't have to, right? Because this is like the other side has won on the conceptual and the ideological front so conclusively that our side is incapable of thinking about how to challenge them, right? So all of the modalities of left activism, or most of the modalities of, I mean, left activism, especially the shit you see on TV, presume the eternal dominance of neoliberal capitalism, and all we're doing is like jockeying around, right? I mean, like within that framework. I mean, even as Walter Ben Michaels and Ken and others have pointed out, reparations is a tort action, right? It's all about a property relation, right? Well, but the idea of restoring Black people to what they might have had if some racist act or practice hadn't intervened, right? I mean, that's a class politics, right? But I mean, despite the fact that there are a lot of people going around making a living now claiming that nobody knew about the Tulsa massacre or about Juneteenth. I found out about Juneteenth at some point in the 70s. It seemed kind of silly to me, and I didn't understand why. I can see why it's a holiday in Galveston. I don't see why anybody else should give a shit about the Juneteenth, but that's neither here nor there. Right, and there are cookout opportunities, and so
you never have enough of those. So.
No. So, and I mean, Lowe's is probably behind it, actually, to sell those grills. But But like Tulsa, like I've known about the Tulsa pogrom, because that's what it was, for a long time. It's only in the past few months and the run-up to the celebration, or I mean commemoration, like of Tulsa this year, that even I knew anything about the Black Wall Street stuff. So then all of a sudden, like the horror of the pogrom isn't the pogrom. It's that this Black business class got destroyed, right? Well, who gives a fuck about the Black business class except the Black business class, right? And I mean, that's not even to get to stuff like this was 1921. 1929 was only eight years later, so some shit was likely to happen then anyway, but you know. But that's kind of where we are. And yeah, I mean, it's frankly, for me, it's becoming more of an effort to dispel or to fight off despair, because I don't think we've got a lot of time. And I'm really afraid about what's going to happen, if not in 2022, at least by 2024. And yeah, I don't know our side is up to the challenge.
We didn't even get into how these anti-racist trainings don't actually work. They don't reduce bias. Right. There's really, you know, they right. may actually make these things worse.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me they would. I saw a couple of reports to that effect. And I didn't think there was anything at all surprising about that, right? That because any process that begins from establishing how we differ instead of finding points of commonality is going to wind up like that. It just feels to me like one of those moments where you really don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind's blowing, right? But if you start out going in that direction, guess what? You're going to wind up in that direction.
Yeah. I guess the last question for me is, having talked to people about this and had arguments about this, the one thing that people say is, well, you know, sort of the rise of kind of Trumpian nationalism or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. Necessitates like a rethink among like a heightened level of awareness about racial politics, because there's this real threat that's rising. Therefore, this kind of thing is necessary and important. And maybe, you know, even if you don't love reading it, like it actually has a positive impact. I wonder what you think about that. Like, part of me, I kind of understand that argument, but the other part thinks it's like, almost like you were saying about COINTELPRO. Like, this is such an off-putting, antagonistic ideology that I imagine that. Overall, it probably has a negative impact politically, and I don't know. I just wondered how to think about that question.
Yeah, thanks. I wonder about that too. I mean, you know, like when the reparations issue, like at the beginning of this century, just somehow wound up back on the table, right? Like, it's kind of funny. I was out of the country for a month in that summer and wasn't paying attention to news here, and got back to find that Johnny Taylor was dead, which really disappointed me, but also that the reparations thing was going around. There were panels and panel discussions and special issues of journals, and I couldn't figure it out. And I was talking to Ray about it. He was in grad school at the time, finishing up. And we watched a panel together on PBS, I think, with Kimberly Crenshaw and Ron Karenga and the Harvard lawyer, Ogletree. And like, this is the kind of thing that lawyers would love, right? Because you can get into it and we can litigate it, right? Until the cows come home. But Karenga said something about free college tuition for Black people. And this was also around the time that the Labor Party actually had started a campaign, or was getting ready to start a campaign for free public college, you know, for everybody. And that, like, so much of our program actually wound up in the Sanders platform, which is cool, I think. But anyway, like when Karenga, I think it was, said that, like, I mean, Teray turned to me and said, so are they recruiting for the Klan, right? I mean, you can imagine going to Michigan and like telling busted, laid off auto workers that, I mean, they've like, they're suffering from a disease called racism, and that they need to atone by paying tax money so Black kids can go to college when their own kids can't go to college. So no, right, I don't think it's useful. I mean, I think what, I mean, there are ways to talk about it, right? I mean, there are ways to talk about race, and mainly the ways to talk about race, I mean, have to do with helping people understand that race is what it has always been, right? The distraction that the people who want to fuck you over won't want to use to divert your attention to the fact that they're in the process of fucking you over. And that seems to me that it's never been clearer, right? It seems to me that that's clearer now than it was at the end of the 19th century. Because at least at the end of the 19th century, like, they had to go out and beat down populists, right? Capital P populists, the real ones. And and by the way, I want to say for the record, there's no such thing as right-wing populism.
Yeah, you so, and Thomas Frank should do a duet.
Yeah, no, show, no, yeah. definitely. Well, and I mean, Walter and I were actually talking about doing an article on that, but I don't know when we'll get around to it. But yeah, no, I would love to do that with Thomas. But yeah, like, at least then it took, you know, force and violence. Now it's like open and every day, like, the MyPillow guy, for God's sake, right? This former dope fiend and convicted felon is getting up on this stuff and it's hustling people on it. And that just says to me more and more, what we need is having frank conversations with actual people in the society, not mediated through mass media, but about what the problems are in their lives. They're anxious about what policy responses would confront them, who's not offering what, and then encouraging that discussion about, you know, for people actually to start thinking about what the society would look like if it were governed by and for the concerns of the working class. And that's got nothing at all to do with Robin, D'Angelo. I mean, people like to read stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, I'll be honest about this too. I mean, to me, there's something that's like, and yeah, I don't think that she is, but there's something that's kind of distastefully Protestant about this to me. It's like atoning in public, marinating oneself in one's own guilt as public performance. And it's just tawdry.
Worth it financially, though. I mean,
oh, yeah. Well, it works out. Yeah, it works out. Yeah.
I mean, she also has worked for the Department of, she's trained the Department of Homeland Security and Department of, Defense.
Oh, my God. Has she really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She makes like $6,000 an hour doing these trainings. It's amazing.
And why do I think that she doesn't talk about imperialism when she's talking to Department of Homeland Security?
Oh, she said that, though, right? I mean, I saw her quoted someplace about a year ago saying, of course, capitalism is back of all of this.
Oh, yeah, she does. She knows. I mean, it's become enough of the thing that she can't pretend it's not there. So she actually says, I have the quote. She goes, more and more wealth is being concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. Where do our leaders direct our attention? To the racial other. To this end, Trump's insistence on calling COVID-19 the China virus was strategic. Class warfare uses racism to divert our attention away from the top and toward the bottom. Dog whistle racism, the use of coded or suggestive language to signal a racist message while still offering plausible deniability, is a tool of class warfare. But she has nothing to suggest about how we deal with this at all.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it's new that she added it because I saw it, like a year or two ago, she said, capitalism is back of it, but I can't talk about that because I wouldn't get invited.
Right. I mean, that. How long is this book, Matt? How many pages is Nice Racism?
It's 224. So it's a short book.
Yeah, so that's the only time I think that she, well, to be fair, it's a short book because it's just it's like a condensed version of her new book. I mean, it's the same book. But
maybe, Matt, like, you just get a deli meal for that one. Cause...
yeah, it's a...
I read the fucking bell curve.
Yeah, ooh, you paid your dues. Yeah. Ooh, yeah, but she, I mean, it is so narcissistic, and I think sometimes the left, my fellow lefties, we can over vilify libs, but she really is like, I mean, there's a part in the book where she talks about how she feels bad that she didn't interrupt when her friend was like giving a lecture. And people were thanking the organization for providing them with anti-racist training. And she realized it was colonizing her friend. They were treating her like imperialist
or something like that. Yeah.
And she regretted not having interrupted it. I was like, what kind of person, Like right. It's all about herself. It's right. all about, yeah. there's so much, all the stuff she claims right. to criticize the white saviorism.
Right.
Like she also seems to have made a lot of mistakes since writing White Fragility. Like I think some of these things are in the time between then and now. How do you not know how to fix this? I guess because you have to constantly be doing a refresher course with Robin DiAngelo to stop yeah. your racism from rearing its head.
Bingo, that's it.
It's amazing how quickly this has become, you know, like a dominant kind of theology. And it's been amazing to watch. But in any case, Professor, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about this.
Thank you so much.
And you got to come back when your book's ready to come out. We got to blow it out for you. So
all right, definitely. I appreciate that. All right, excellent. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks so much. All right, take care now.
Bye. Take care.
I remember your blazing hatred for all things Duke. Are you watching? Are there any Dukies in the finals right now?
No.
You got a Wake Forest guy.
Yeah, well, right? Actually, there's a Tar Heel on each team.
Oh, right. Cam Johnson and. Right.
And Justin Jackson, who hasn't played.
Right. Yeah, hasn't played. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do think that, I understand why Roy resigned. And, and I think that Hubert Davis was the proper choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, no, he's a smart guy.
And I think he's going to help with the recruiting, and he's like deeply committed to the program and to the university. So the kids who want to go to college for at least a couple of years and their families are likely to be moved by that, where the rat over there in Durham kind of get all the.
So this isn't a joke. You have like a Duke, for real, yeah. You can't send it.
No. In fact, I gave a talk at Carolina a number of years ago at the library, and I pointed out that one of the things I learned in Chapel Hill was the real meaning of primordial hatred. Tutsis to me, right? I can't stand that shade of blue. I can't like the lettering on the Gothic lettering turned my stomach. I mean, no, it's like total revulsion.
That's really funny. they also the kind of like Duke diaspora, the way they pal around with each other, and like after they get to the league, that's a little tough to take. I'm a Celtics fan, so I have to live with it because of Jason Tatum. But
for a while, it looked like here the fucking Pelicans are going to do an all Duke roster,
right?
Right, but
yeah.
Zion, who really wasn't there for long enough to count, right?
But
got Redick from the Phillies or from the 76ers. Yeah, but he's gone now. Graham, or Ingram, rather.
Ingram, yep, that's right.
But I just look the other way.
In 1 minute, we're going to just weigh in on this major media beef war.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
So here's what I'm saying. We got Aaron Mate, friend of show Aaron Mate, right? Former guest, Jimmy Dore. One-time guest, Cenk Uygur. Never guest, never in the past. I'm going to guess never in the future. Anna Kasparian. Who am I leaving out? They are beefing. And then now Kyle has been pulled into the fold. Ryan Grimm was already there. We should get him on the show. And people are demanding that people comment on this, right? So Kyle, Jimmy wanted Kyle to comment, and then Kyle commented, and now Jimmy went out, debriefed, let's say, Kyle's commentary. But I'm saying, Kyle, look, there's a whole world out there that's been silent, and your silence is complicity, okay? So Kyle Kalinske, he co-hosts a show. Who does he co-host that show with? Crystal Ball.
Crystal, her silence.
Your
is deafening.
Silence is deafening. Okay, Crystal Ball, you host a show with Sagar and Jetty. Sagar, what say ye?
Right.
What say ye? Sagar, you co-host a show.
Put up or shut up.
Put up or shut up.
Just put up.
Yes. Speak out or get out.
Mm-hmm.
You host a podcast, and that podcast is co-hosted with someone else. Named Marshall Kosloff, and I want to know where Marshall comes down on this. Marshall, you coward. Comment, you coward.
Right. Right. All these people on the sidelines, they have no backbone.
They are like, what's his name? They are like J.D. Vance.
Just blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
You know,
so
has Nathan Robinson weighed in on this yet?
Don't know if he has. But if he hasn't,
we need 26,000 words from Nathan on this.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll be disappointed if it's anything less than 20. Let's put it that way.
Marshall is at the Hudson Institute. Speaking of which, I want all the Hudson Institute experts. I'm talking David Asher. I'm talking both Marshalls. Marshall as in Sagar and Jetty's, but also Marshall Billingsley, who's a fellow there. Did you know Billingsley? That they got, yeah, is that how you say it?
Probably.
Marshall Billingsley. Yeah, Marshall Billingsley. Casey Mitchell, Michelle, who hates us, who hates me. Where do you stand?
How about Penny Marshall?
I want Penny Marshall. She's still alive?
Well, death is not an excuse in this situation.
You know what?
She's dead?
Yeah, she's dead. That's convenient.
Yeah.
That's convenient. You think that's going to stop us from asking for a comment?
Right.
Especially if she's not an atheist.
Hiding behind the coffin, as they say.
Is that a thing?
No.
Oh, hiding behind the tombstone.
Right,
Tombstone head. Oh, all right, hiding in the coffin, like the mayor in Peru, remember?
Right, yeah, exactly. So our goal this week is to get Crystal and Sagar to weigh in.
Marshall. And at least two Marshalls at the Hudson Institute.
At least two of the Marshalls and at least 20,000 Nathan Robinson words.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how many? Crystal, Sagar, Marshall 1, Marshall 2, Nathan. So we got five, going once, going twice. We got a week to get these five individuals. But what if we don't get them to do it? What's that going to mean?
Well, can we provoke somebody to do, like, you know what we should do? We should tell one of the principals, one of the more excitable principals, that these people are talking shit about them.
Right.
Behind their back.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah.
Let's send emails. Did you hear what Nathan said about you?
We'll do a screen grab. I'll write it right now.
I'll be like, exactly.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a PS to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the PS first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.